Hey there. This ad caught your attention. It also caught the attention of the coolest people from Squamish to Bellingham. Music fans, students, and members of various cultural communities. If you want your ad to do the same, advertise with CITR and Discorder. If you've got a rad new ad or just something you want to share, whether in print, on air, or online, promote your wares, services, or events with us. Contact us at advertising@citr.ca or call 604-822-4342. Visit citr.ca for rates, information, and packages. This is the end of our ad, and if you're still here, we must be doing something right.
There's a lot of talk about expectations in the April issue of Discorder, the expectations that we set for ourselves and others, and how we act when those expectations are not met. Experimental sound artist Ian William Craig discusses the nature of success. Bridget Gallagher makes us think about moshing in a new light. Una Craig dissects gentricide in the downtown East Side. And April cover artist Janine Frey and Jute Lee advocates for the protection of caribou, amongst other things. Thanks to this month's advertisers, CITR 101.9 FM, the Rickshaw Theater, Timber Concerts, the Rio Theater, the Wise Hall, Live Van, Alex Cuba, the UBC AMS, Red Cat Records, High Life Records, Audio Pile Records, Neptune Records, Jazz Records, Mint Records, the Rickshaw, RSD, and Doxa. Welcome to a new season.
National Canadian Film Day 150 is a massive one-day celebration of Canadian cinema. On April 19th, great Canadian movies will be available at over 1,700 screenings in cinemas, libraries, public squares, and anywhere you can show a film. The best part of all? These screenings are completely free to the public. In Vancouver alone, there will be 22 events happening on one day. To celebrate at UBC, the film department is showcasing a brand new documentary on April 18th, and Mina Shum's Double Happiness will be playing on April 19th, following a Q&A with the filmmaker herself. More information can be found at CanadianFilmDay.ca.
Listening to CITR 101.9 FM, we broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Hunkamina-speaking Coast Salish Musqueam people. My name is Josh Gabardoyan, and you're listening to Textbook. Today on the show, an audio diary documenting a project I was working on earlier in the semester for class with Dr. Fenwal Antwi here at the UBC Department of English Literature. The audio diary follows an investigation into the life of Joseph Serafin Fortes, more commonly known as Joe Fortes, who was an early black settler here in Vancouver and the city's first official lifeguard. The project was completed with five other UBC students, Evan Morrison-Glavick, Megan Hollick, Rushing Telfer, Dylan Ferguson, and Tom Lougheed. So you'll hear their voices on the course of this hour as well. You'll hear a variety of discussions and ambient sounds collected through the course of the project. You'll hear our trip to English Bay Beach, where Joe lived and worked. You'll hear us at the Vancouver City Archives combing through documents. You'll hear an interview with Lisa Ann Smith, the author of the only book-length biography of Joe. And you'll hear an interview with Carlos Castro, who's played Joe in revival performances. You'll also hear the song Old Black Joe, a minstrel song that was played at Joe Fortes' funeral. Today, you'll hear it performed with altered lyrics by the civil rights activist Paul Robison. The audio diary is non-linear, and it's meant to capture some of the different sounds, experiences, and reflections from the archive. So, without further ado, here it is, Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM.
Language of this inscription. This fountain erected by the citizens and children, not just citizens, cooperating with the Kiwanis Club of Vancouver, commemorates the life and deeds of, quote, Joe, unquote, Fortes, for many years guardian of this beach. Little children loved him, AD 1927. We were talking about the fact that citizens and children, because little children aren't citizens, the kind of folkloric language of life and deeds, quotation marks around Joe, the lack of Serafin on the monument, and in the literature about Joe Fortes, the kind of constant reference to children, little children loving him, kids going, you know, to his cottage and him swimming, teaching children on the beach, and how this is kind of, I don't know, in like the age of pathologization of pedophilia. It sounds a bit weird to our ears, but maybe in 1927 it didn't.
In 2006, they had a what was called a Sea Vancouver Festival. It was actually a regular festival in the spring. They had was called a Sea Fest, I think, back in the earlier days. I guess in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, they stopped it for about 10 years due to some problems, I guess, and they wanted to do the Sea Vancouver Festival. The mayor and the city of Vancouver wanted to put on tall ships coming in and have some heritage characters play, you know, some characters for the kids, you know, and from the community. And we had different tents and setups around the,
seals are great.
The city. Six-day festival, I believe. And they wanted a Joe Fortes character, and there was one person who casted a few of us, and I thought, great, yeah, as an actor, a roaming
just
character,
100
go
years
around
ago.
And
none of these buildings would have been.
And,
yeah,
good.
Cool.
Well, I, as an actor, I thought, well, you know, it's really good.
This is your moment,
just
trying
to, you know, and find out who the man is.
So this is it.
Just that, you know, he came from West Indies and getting
and now
he spent 5 years in Liverpool.
Great docs.
Was celebrated as a champion swimmer there. But he was
like big lifeguard chairs. Obviously, he wouldn't have had one of those.
Basically, you know,
in like
English Bay,
saved
so many lives, you know.
Beach,
and,
like,
it
was probably not
so
be one lifeguard
was scatter
for,
of all of his accomplishments, but
an
not much known about
it.
Right.
So maybe he just had like one bit.
Just as a black actor, I'm actually an American, permanent resident here in Canada, but I thought, I want to find out what's going on with this brother, you know? Who is this man, you know? I was working on a couple of screenplays before, co-wrote some screenplays, and I thought, okay, this is a story maybe that might be kind of interesting. Well, I outlined it, and I couldn't find out enough, and I thought I'd just use a creative license, but I got stuck, and I put it in the back burner. So Lisa Ann Smith came out with, our friend Joe, the Joe Fortes story. And I just, I got the book and I was taking a train down to California and I was just picking it up, dropping it down, going, this is amazing. This is all the resources I need. Certainly if I had to do any of the further research, it was all in the book. And I found Lisa Ann Smith and told her about my project, and the first thing she said was, "Oh, you look so much like Joe." I said, "Look, I just love this book. I have the screenplay, and I want you to maybe consult with me, and then go from there." So rather than write a linear type of story just based on the historical perspective of him, I thought maybe I'd try something where I could take the events and the characters and create an original story. I told her, I said, I want you to consult with me. So after a year, and using a lot of creative license, I did finish the screenplay a year ago, and I want to, my whole thing was, I want to bring Joe to the big screen because I think that he's an important black Canadian who contributed so much to the immediate community and also the broader community.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah. So we'll see if we can make a Canadian British Canadian movie out of it. I'm working on some things. Anyway.
Cool.
Yeah, that's how it'll happen. I still play Joe, by the way. I do some things with Lisa. You know, when she does her slideshow.
Oh, cool.
We plan on some stuff too. I love to play Joe.
Okay, so what was it? Yeah, what was it like the very first time playing him at this festival though? What was that experience like?
It was wonderful. It was roaming characters or heritage characters. Mm-hmm. It's a little different than, you know, being on stage or in front of a camera. Mm-hmm. I do some film and TV work, but I just thought, you know, the first thing I thought was kids. And there's all these really sweet little faces, and they're all like, you know, and a song would come up, a story or a joke would come up, and it was just, I could be very free. There was another character who was, she was sort of one of the, I don't know if she was an actual character from that period of time, but she was I call her the lady comic, and she had her little umbrella and a period piece, 1800s outfit, and she was, oh, Joe, come on now, you know, we have to go on to the next stop, you know. Mm-hmm. So I had somebody to play off to, and kind of a straight man or a straight woman or a straight person, and she was so much fun. It was about the kids, and so, you know, before they would board onto the tall ships, I would tell my stories, or we'd go into a, you know, a little crafts area, and we just wander and roam, and just it was fascinating. It was a lot of fun, just being sort of loose and free to play that character.
Yeah,
and it was a great experience. Yeah.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's kind of cool. You know, it's interesting too, because it's kind of like similar to what Joe was doing in a sense, right? Like that was what Joe was all about as well. It's like, you know, being there for the kids and supporting the kids, and I think that's
yeah, and the parents loved it too.
Yeah,
it was all good. Yeah, so. I really enjoyed it, and I think that was probably the greatest part of the experience.
And then how has it been like, you know, with Lisa playing the character, how has your kind of understanding of him changed, you know, as an actor?
Well, that's a good question. There's a when the book came out, and then she had her first presentation with a slideshow at the old mill store, mm-hmm. which is one of the oldest buildings in Vancouver. And, mm-hmm. It was down in the Gastown area there, and then they moved the building over to Point Grey Road in Alma, just near the Jericho Beach.
No, there's no
and it still
here.
Stands. And she's one of
she's behind the desk or something, isn't she?
Yeah, she works there. Yeah, she does some volunteering there, and she did a slideshow, and she invited some people out, and I missed the first one, and she just said, "Why don't you play Joe and come into the slideshow?" So I wrote up a little mini script that played off of that, of me just sort of the ghost coming back as Joe, and. And she had the slideshow, I would each particular slide of the that related to the book, you know, that was on there, all the photos and all that, and I would just sort of play off angles. Yes, I remember Martha Scurry, and I'd tell a story, and then goes, "Oh, that's or that would be the bathhouse that I was in Liverpool, and then how I swam across the River Mersey, and tell a story about that." And then I certainly borrowed some of my own parts of scripts that I had, mm-hmm. or tell a story of how I, you know, I used some creative license when I wrote the screenplay. Mm-hmm. So I, but yeah, it was great to meet her and then tell her, you know, I want to, mm-hmm. you know, after reading her book, I was just so excited.
Yeah. I bet that must have been like crazy because it is this really extensive book that she's done, you know?
There was so little known, and I put it back on the back burner. I read the book. I couldn't drop it. I was like, oh, this is it. All the research and all the stuff was there, and it was amazing. So I thought, okay, now I'll bring the screenplay back up, and I thought, okay, now I can tell this story. So I actually contacted her. founder, and we sat down several times. I said, listen, I'm doing this screenplay, and I want you to consult with me and help me with this, and she did. And but I wanted to use creative license. I didn't want to write a linear type of story based on just the historical thing. I'm sure you read the book as well.
Yeah.
Our friend Joe, the Joe Fortes story. And I thought, okay, good, but I found one interesting thing about the book. They said that Joe was interviewed by a newspaper reporter that wanted to tell his story. And forgive me, I can't remember his name, but
I know the article you're talking about, though. It was in The Province, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Province. And, Joe's response was, write a book. He goes, well, I got my own story right here. I keep it with me. And I thought, you know, it's like, yeah, I said, okay, that means that he carried some kind of diary or some book that he had. And then the last caption in the interview, remember, it says, Unfortunately, that book has never been found. And I went, oh, my God.
Yeah.
So I said, what I'll do is I'll take the story and use it as a flashback. So one of the things about Joe when he passed away that, you know, there were certain family members that he was connected with. You know about Martha Scurry, who the Scurry family, the husband had the barbershop, and and when he passed away, she had all these children to take care of, and Joe came in and moved into a boarding house with her and helped her out as a sort of family member and friend.
It's a big old coincidence.
And,
it's a coincidence that we come upon the library.
So that's how they developed their relationship.
Know about
but
on Joe
was the youngest. She was the only girl.
20 after one.
Only young girl. And
pretty,
she gets married. Apparently, the story shows that on his deathbed,
a reading with Lisa Ann Smith,
that he and
her oh my god, we can ask
you to ask her so many questions.
Yeah, that's pretty unreal.
Yeah, that's great.
A special photo of his drumming circle.
We're coming as the biggest fans with the book on
which is
we love you.
Watch out, this guy wants to crack. Do you think we'll be the only ones there?
No.
Very strong.
I met the other group in the class that's doing.
Oh my god.
Also
yeah.
Is there someone else doing?
Yeah, we're not the only one.
Oh, I thought we were.
Should we fortify ourselves before we go there? I need a bite to eat.
Alright. Yeah, let's have some food and coffee.
Yeah.
We're walking in late. We're gonna be the obnoxious.
I hate being late.
Kind of five people wandering in.
Like hold the book so that it looks like.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my god, where's the book? Oh my god.
Okay.
Good.
Okay.
What are you feeling right now going into a?
Oh my god.
Just how are you feeling? Just tell me a little bit.
I'm excited actually. There, on the side it said there was like a drumming circle also, which I think could be really interesting, and pictures, and the author of our book, which is actually so random and exciting.
That's great.
That's super interesting. What was it? What was it that you got snagged on the first time when you were writing it?
I'm sorry, the what?
What was it that you got snagged on the first time when you were writing it? Or you said you kind of got stuck when you started writing the screenplay at first.
Well, yeah, there wasn't enough information, but it was really, I think it was overall, I think that there were details about his life in Liverpool that was much broader. Certain people in his life, and more than just receiving this award or, you know, from the Lord Mayor's daughter for a swimming thing, but that he was a daredevil, and that he was this one man witnessed him swimming across the Mersey River, you know, to go see his girlfriend, this Irish girl. So I created a character about this Irish girl. A love affair, you know, and I created that. But this one man is Flagstaff. I can't remember the first one. Anyway, he was the one of the major members of this Daredevil society, an underground society, right?
Mm.
And he convinces Joe to be a part of this race. And he says, we're going to put on a race where you can swim. Who would be the winner to swim across the River Mersey, this oily, you know, really...
industrial, eh? Yeah.
Waters, yeah. You know all that story.
Yeah.
Well, I used that story, and he actually did swim. There was a race. And not only did he win the race, but one of the competitors cramped up and was stuck in the water. He swims back in and saves his life and brings him to shore.
So yeah, that's great.
I think that's what started me. I went like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then... there wasn't a lot of detail about him being a sailor, but certainly as a cargo sailor, that was a lot of adventures. But what brought him to Victoria, where he broke down, ship broke down, it was towed into Broad Inlet. It's like, okay, well, here's a man that wasn't even planning on being in Vancouver. So he ends up here, I guess, stranded. What do I do? And, you know, he goes into this new town called Granville at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's, I guess, wandering about. He works on the old beat-up ship to be a watchman for a while, but he didn't like that. And then he ends up working at this called the Sunnyside Hotel. And it was pretty well-known. A lot of government people were people that were pretty well-off in the same place. It was a really nice place. And so I was using the story with him, you know, making friends with the owner and saying, hey, I can help you out with, you know, some of the, I guess he was doing the carpentry work. And he said, well, you know, you can be the...
Sound check here. Does that sound all right? Can you hear me? Great. Okay. So I don't have to project too far and go halfway through this. So, as Jane mentioned, we're going to learn about that today about Joe 40.
Can I try it? Says Joe on it, supposedly in his own, like, based on his real signature. So that's kind of cool.
It's a really nice cane.
Yeah, it was pretty good. It was a gift.
Yeah. It's kind of nice to see something that he would have been really kind of like an everyday kind of object.
Yeah.
Rishin, where are we going right now?
We are going to the restaurant, the Joe Fortis restaurant, to have a little look at it.
We're continuing the pilgrimage.
The pilgrimage, yeah. Them to have developed out of Joe, like the emphasis on being a friend and with the children. Like I would have thought, like a children's center, a swim school, being like oysters. I don't know. I need to look it up, see like what the
fancy restaurant.
Yeah, it didn't seem like I don't know.
Yeah,
the essence of Joe, the vibe.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, to spend loads of money on food when he, like, worked for free for, like, 20 years. Seems odd.
It looks so fancy and stuff.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, so we are in Lisa Ann Smith's house, who is the author of Our Friend Joe, the autobiography of... the biography, sorry, of Joe Fortis. And she's... We've just been explaining what our archival project is about, and she's about to very generously show us all of the information that she used for her book, all of her research. So yeah, so we're going to look through it. How should we... Yeah.
It's all a little bit haphazard, but if you like, we can go through it. It might be it. Some of this material belongs to Barbara Rogers. She was the co-author, and she sadly passed away 4 years ago. So she's
right. So that's just the cremation and memorial services that went. Yeah.
I had friends who worked there.
Really?
Yeah.
What was it like?
I think pretty straightforward.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. You work by yourself a lot, and the hours are a bit strange, but. You have to be of a particular constitution, I'd imagine.
Yeah. Why the hours strange? Is it a lot of...
Well, I think sometimes they just need to get cremations done.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
It costs less to cremate someone. Like a day.
Really?
Yeah. Like, early in the morning and stuff. Or like, also, like, if you transport the body yourself. This is like, this is my granny's like, my dad is just researching all of it. It's like just such a weird, like, practical thing that you have to do. He's like, I don't want to pay someone to take the body. But I was like, how are you going to, like, it doesn't even matter what kind of day you
get. Yeah.
I don't know, it seems really, it's like,
the practicality is
a deal.
A deal, yeah, it is.
You know, like, if you go at 7 o'clock in the morning,
tell us where we are right now. There's this whole thing about,
yeah,
like, how do we interact with dead
cemetery
bodies too, and like, oh, we're talking about
on
medicalization of death.
Fraser.
Yeah.
Super interesting.
Standing at Joe Forter's grave. Grave.
Oh, and we just did a...
We just tried to do an etching of his grave, but it's the ground's pretty wet, so it didn't go amazingly.
Like having a body in the house?
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the
yeah,
do they really?
There's a cross on one side,
yeah,
and then there's the beach chair, lifeguard chair on the other side.
It's not just a cross, it's a crucifix with the figure of Jesus. And the chair is empty on the other side. And they're about the same height, but the scale is completely different.
Okay.
The chair is much larger than the crucifix. And at the base of the lifeguard chair is a life-saving ring with lines around it that make it appear as though it's in the water.
Not very tasteful. Man.
I'm wondering if the crucifix...
I don't know if it would be more tasteful.
I don't know if it's just there for religious purposes or maybe to symbolize his sacrifice. You know how he sacrificed him... Not sacrifice, he dedicated so much of his time and he did so much of it unpaid. I don't know if that's significant. Mm. But above that old... Above the new one, there's his original grave, which just has Joe inscribed in.
Right. So the new one is kind of like a granite, I think?
Blue granite.
Blue granite. And the older one is kind of a slab of something.
Yeah, probably, I don't know.
Some sort of stone.
Sandstone, maybe.
Sandstone.
I'm glad that they've used his full name. I'm glad it's not just Joe. Even though I'm sure he was, well, it seems like he was known by Joe and was happy to be known by Joe, but I think it's important to have the seraphim there.
It would have been one of the earlier ones in Liverpool. It was built, I can't quite remember the exact date that it was built. It's very Googleable. You can find it.
Yeah,
there's some pictures. See here, actually opened 1828. There you go.
Yeah.
And then it was eventually torn down. It's interesting, we went to Liverpool a few years ago and you know, retraced Joe's steps, and we're on the bank of the River Mersey, weren't we, and about where the pool would have stood, and now it's a Canada Plaza or something. There were maple trees there.
Weird.
It's a bit ironic, yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, Doug used to live in Liverpool, so.
Only for a brief period of time.
I think we got that.
Come on, Evan.
You want to recap?
I don't want to recap. No, I want something else to recap. Tom?
What is there to say? We went to the archives, found some hopefully useful stuff. I don't know what else to... what else is there?
Pictures, some newspaper clippings.
Yeah. I think that's about it.
Did anything unexpected happen?
There was no internet at all, so we had to do everything just like manually, kind of. We couldn't look up like where specific things would be, so we had to reference the book a lot, our friend Joe.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I guess I was surprised at how personal some of the archiving was. A lot of it to do with J.S. Matthews' work and commentary, handwritten commentary, like layers of interpretation on some of the documents. That was pretty neat.
Liverpool author named Tom Slemon, and he'd written, hey, stop that. He'd written up on this secret daredevil club that used to meet on Duke Street. It was quite a fashionable men's club, you know, for doing amazing stunts and feats, and this sea captain had witnessed Joe swimming across the Mersey River late at night on the deer. So he decided, oh, this is the perfect guy to have it in the Daredevil Club.
Is this important?
So, sorry, Joe's first swim was not on the deer. We gather he was swimming across to meet a girlfriend on the other side or something.
Dedication.
So, and wanted to impress her. Yeah, who knows. But anyway, then he was invited to join the Daredevil Club and met these two other guys and challenged each other to swim across the Mersey River in the dead of night. So we actually went down to the place where we would have swum across. And, you know, so it would have been quite a feat for sure.
He worked also really interesting. This is to the Daredevil Club was kind of like upper class kind of club. And Joe.
Yeah, and I don't know where he got this information. He said he had a sword.
Cricket was nice because it was very
passed away. So.
Good memory.
From Derek Whale.
Derek Whale.
What have you guys requested here? Is it just a file on Joe?
This was just the file that I had written down as like one of the. I think I was sure.
Ran with it.
And it just seems to be the Joe Forge's file. But I also requested one on the same with the petition, but like the
clippings and
that was the Joe.
Sure.
Floor plan of the.
We had that coming.
The pierhead bath.
How was it?
Give us a bit of an idea. I had to use my imagination a bit and try to get inside Joe's head and what it would have been like there.
I was going to ask about that because the fire, I've read the first half of it and it's quite like fictionalized. How did you decide on that kind of mode of writing?
I think that's what you have to do if you want to engage your reader. You know, Ronsdale Press, the publishing company that I work with, they seem to be quite happy with that, as long as the basic storyline is true. You know, so it's what you call creative nonfiction. So where you inject a little bit of creative license into it. I'm doing that with another book I'm having published this next fall. I mean, I'm doing that heavily in the next one.
Yeah.
An English prof from UBC.
Yeah, Ron Hatch. I think he's been retired for a few years.
Daughters of BC Writers.
It's a great guy.
And he's working at the publisher. He was like,
Well, he's the publisher.
Volunteering, and she told us that it's been around since.
Because we're still trying to decide on.
You have to be from British Columbia. You have to evince an interest in local history, and you have to.
Well, this is it. Yeah. So you've got to. You've got to.
She mentioned that they're trying to like change the. So that you don't have to be born in BC.
This is like a massive.
But yeah. That's wild.
Well, a lot of this is Barbara's, and some of it.
And the place is really old school. You can tell that like most of that. But I don't know. There's like an interesting interest of generations there. Kind of falling.
Oh really?
Yeah. Young woman, middle-aged woman, older woman.
What was she? Because Evan
was
also working with us. He wanted to
talk
about his feeling ill today, and he was wondering about how.
I really like this one.
Because obviously, how you link Joe's life to the history of of Black history in Vancouver, and how much you wanted to. Bring that into your work, or was that the kind of tangent that
focus on that too much? Because I think Joe didn't really want that feeling of a divide. He was just a regular guy that wanted to be a part of the community, you know. And if kids called him the N word, here comes N word Joe, and he would just. Politely say to them, just call me Joe. You know, he didn't get offended. There was no sense of any animosity. There were maybe a couple of incidents where racism may have played a part, but I think for him it was more about just being accepted as a person rather than a person of color. Just he was more interested in just being accepted for who he was, as opposed to his nationality.
Because,
I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no,
I'm much better at writing than I am at...
No, not at all. No, I was just thinking. So, I feel like that's
Yeah, I just, you know, from coming to know him as we did over the years, he did have a bit of an inferiority complex, but I don't think it was anything to do with his color. I think it was more just about who he was as a person. He might have been a little bit conscious of the fact that he was not that scholarly, you know, like this is an example here of his autograph.
Oh yeah, we have a couple cuts in the archives.
Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. We do.
So it's written in Spanish.
Yeah, which was kind of
interesting. Yeah, and it's very stilted, and it looks as if he's thought really hard. And the rough translation is "Antiquity This" of Seraphim Forties, and then Major Matthews made notes underneath. Not being a good scholar, he did the best he could and probably tried to say this is a relic or souvenir of Seraphim 40s, i.e. Joe 40s of English Bay.
Yeah, because I thought it was so interesting at the library the other day when mm-hmm. the historian whose name, I can't remember, who did a talk after you was saying,
He was wanting the contact information. We had to dash away because... Her son was coming
back. Okay, so the debate was he was thinking that she didn't include enough about Hogan's Alley.
Yeah, I thought he was arguing that Joe Fortes and the other two families, the Phillips and the Scurries, started the black community in Vancouver that like preceded the black community of Hogan's Alley, and by leaving out Hogan's Alley and the black community that they created, she was erasing black history in Vancouver of Hogan's Alley. Is that what he was saying?
I didn't get that impression, but I might have misunderstood.
It was either that or that like the history of Hogan's Alley is like really focused on, and they forget about like Joe Fortes and those people who were here before.
Yeah.
Like they started the black community, but they before that book weren't getting enough like.
I think he might have been saying both things.
He might have been saying both things. I got both things during that. Yeah.
I mean, she doesn't focus on the. I mean, she does, and he said this, that she focuses on the community in the book. So if you've read some of the book, like that when she's talking about, when they, the two authors, are talking about the Scurries and Gastown, there is more talk about the community, but she doesn't talk about a black community. And I think that's maybe what he was taking issue with. Because she doesn't talk about blackness or a black community in Vancouver.
There's almost a sense that, like, the friend is, like, this weird...
Deracialization
and, like, way of, like, erasing difference. Like, our friend Joe, like...
Like I was saying to you before, like, it seems like it's such, like, sort of, like, heartwarming, like, civic history that, like, makes it... But you were telling me that story about Louis Armstrong, and it made me think about, like... you know, the fact that it probably wasn't all that peachy for the entire time. Like,
yeah. There's a story about Louis Armstrong I heard on Thursday. I did an interview with somebody for a radio documentary about vaudeville history in Vancouver. And apparently when Louis Armstrong played here, you know, he had this great set at this, you know, nice kind of restaurant bar. And this white, like, kid came up to him after and was like, "Hey, Louis, that was, like, an amazing set. You know, I'm a huge fan. Of your stuff, and that was great to hear you play." And Louis Armstrong was like, "Hey, thanks, man. Like, I appreciate it. Do you want to come out for a drink with us after?" And the white boy was just like, "No, I'd never come out with a drink with you. You're a Negro. Like, there's no way." And just like absolute like reversal. Just like, I love to hear you play, but I won't have a drink with you. And just this very, like, that was in
same
Vancouver.
Thing as, like, artists having to enter through the rear, you know, entrances. Like, they were still, people were still going to see them. And, like, you know, they were, especially, like, Louis Armstrong. But, like, yeah, it's still obviously segregated. So.
I mean, I think there's that sense with, yeah.
Like, I wonder, there doesn't seem to be a lot of that in, like, the recorded history of Joe Fortes, so.
Yeah, there definitely isn't that much in the book, parts of the book that we've
pretty washed over.
Yeah.
You know, they don't know the brother.
Mm-hmm.
I want him to be known. So there's pride. I mean, that's one thing about today is, like, you know, we're still celebrating our black pride. There's still struggles,
mm-hmm.
And there's still racism, and there's still prejudice. But, you know, it certainly would help. And you as a student, you want to learn more about that,
mm-hmm.
and want to learn more about Joe, I'm thinking it's a wonderful thing. I'm glad that you called me, and
Yeah.
I hope that you take some of this and compare, you know, to what's going on today. I think it's better. Things are getting better. I think that we're always constantly learning. But then look at our children and our children in the future coming up. You know, it's like we have to set a platform of something that's going to be a way of pulling ourselves together, not just as Black Canadians, but one Canada and one America, too, because I'm an American, too.
Right, right.
One world, you know.
The dogs are coming out onto the Mersey River. It's very sunny, windy day in Liverpool.
I just got off the phone with Ivan Sayers, a fashion archivist, former employee of Museum of Vancouver, left the museum in 1991. I asked him about handkerchiefs that he had seen that had been given to very young women at the time in the 1910s who had passed Joe Fortis's swimming lessons and had been given these handkerchiefs as a reward. He described them as being tissue paper thin and dead plain, no border, no monogram. He thought that they may have cost about 5 cents when they'd been bought, and likely they'd come from Japan, and Joe Fortis had bought them in Chinatown. He said that the two elderly ladies who approached him with these handkerchiefs sometime in the late 80s, even though they had approached him, I think, a few years apart, had expressed the same sense of gratitude and being touched by Joe Fortis's gesture so many decades ago. And both of these women who Mr. Sayers called with a lot of tenderness Carisdale matrons were moved to tears by this gesture. And coincidentally, Mr. Sayers told me that a few weeks ago he'd been contacted by someone else who happened to have one of these handkerchiefs, and not thinking it very valuable, but understanding its history, had offered it to Mr. Sayers. And at the point at which we spoke, Mr. Sayers was still waiting for waiting to hear back from this person, from this man who's in possession of this handkerchief. And while he's been waiting, he has contacted the Museum of Vancouver, Wendy Nichols, the curator there, to see if they still have the original two handkerchiefs that were given to the museum in the 80s. And unfortunately, Wendy Nichols wasn't able to locate these handkerchiefs. So they're probably still at the museum, he speculates, but they're not in the database, so it's a matter of finding them. He suggested finding the Woodward's catalog for that period, which belongs to the city archives, and checking it against the price that he imagined the handkerchiefs would have summoned in the 1910s, which is 5 cents. A very erudite and well-spoken, considerate man, Mr. Sayers.
Okay, so we've just left Lisa's house, Lisa and Doug's house, Megan and I, and we've been up for about an hour interviewing her and looking through her stuff. I didn't get this bit, and I'm gonna tell it just because it was so interesting. There's a man called Carlos Costa who has written a screenplay about Joe Fortis, but apparently is quite heavily fictionalized.
Mm-hmm.
I was like concentrating on a supposed love affair between Joe and Martha Scurry, just going to go into the street. But apparently this guy is a, I don't know, like he sounds like a Joe enthusiast, I guess. And yeah. He even calls himself Joe and apparently can do a really great...
Joe impression.
Yeah, a really great Caribbean accent. So I think we're going to try and contact him because he sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
I want to read the screenplay.
Me too.
Did you have any thoughts on that interview, Megan?
Okay, thoughts on the interview. I don't know. I was really interested in just like, I don't know, like her, when she was talking about like why, like the things that they didn't want to include about like his race and like that he was just, he just wanted to be a normal guy. Like he just wanted to like fit in with, or like, I don't know. I don't remember exactly what she said, but it's good that we recorded it. Something about just like, just wanted to be accepted for who he was as a person.
Yeah, she seemed to imagine that Joe didn't have, his identity wasn't attached to his race.
Right.
Her focus was on his attachment to the community, but in a way that was like, when we asked about it, I thought it was verging on awkward.
It was verging on awkward.
It was tense. Like, she didn't want to talk about that.
No,
when she
talked
about that postcard, it kind of just, like came up. Like, that postcard.
Like, she didn't bring it up. Like, Doug brought it up. Like, her husband.
Yeah.
Her husband brought it up.
Yeah. That,
I was just talking about how the publisher didn't want to put it in the book.
Because it wasn't politically correct. It's like, well, obviously it's not politically correct.
Obviously. Like,
it's not even negotiably, like...
Yeah.
I mean, it was straight, like, out and out racist, but she didn't want to put it in because it was, like, unpleasant. And she was saying, like, that was the approach of people at the time. Those were those, like, views.
Right.
But we didn't want to include them, which was super interesting because it's... I don't think that's the approach that we're taking to our
No, not at all. Like, I think that it's really important that she wrote the book, but I do feel like it's important that we're doing a project sort of like on, I don't know, like on what was left out of that book even. You know what
yeah.
I mean? Like, yeah, I don't know. It was just interesting how she thought that like he wasn't really part of a black community. He just wanted to be accepted into the wider community.
Yeah.
But like...
There's not really any evidence for that, though. The fact
yeah.
that his
closest
friends...
Yeah.
Yeah, and when we said, like, that his closest friends were the Scurries who were black,
African, yeah.
she was saying, yeah, but he had such a close tie to the community.
With everyone.
That's such a different relationship with, like, the children who come to the beach. He was, like, a service, you know,
yeah.
like... Everyone was very grateful for him, and he wanted to do that service, but
yeah.
it was different
as you said, like,
to his for his family, essentially. Like,
yeah, it definitely wasn't just a coincidence that, like, his closest tie was another family who was also black. Like,
yeah.
I think it's not like he wasn't... Yeah, I think that kind of shows that, like, definitely part of his identity was, like, you know, at least partially determined, obviously,
yeah.
by his color, being in, like, being, like, an othered... body in like
yeah.
white Vancouver, like
yeah
that's
and
definitely left out of the book.
Yeah, and I think the book kind of it might be an exaggeration to say the book continues that narrative that we saw in the clippings of like the poems that were written after his death.
Yeah,
that were saying like
he was the whitest black man I ever saw, or like
yeah or
I
like,
ever knew, or like he was
had the best heart for a black man, you know.
Yeah.
Just like
he had the white heart for a black man.
Yeah, and it seems to that erasure of his racial identity kind of continues, not directly, but kind of like
I agree, absolutely,
like kind of continues that narrative.
Yeah.
I think because it just puts Joe as this like person in the community when
he was just, everybody really liked him. He was just really
yeah.
lovable. He just wanted to be accepted as a person, not as like obviously, but like, you know
yeah.
what I mean? But like,
but realistically,
like,
he wasn't.
Exactly.
Because
realistically,
if you say to
he wasn't. Like, based on just all the newspaper clippings, and there are a lot of references to like him being a black man, or like, you know, like that comes up so often.
Yeah.
It obviously was not a non issue.
Yeah. It was how he was identified a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really interesting. But I'm super grateful to her for doing that.
It was
that.
So
like,
nice.
Really lovely.
It was
her.
So
she's
nice.
So much research.
They were pretty cute, also, I thought.
Yeah.
Her husband was so cute.
I know. Doug from the Isle of Man. And also, just side note to the audio recording. The dog Sandy, the dog
Sunny.
The dog Sunny features heavily. At one point, she was breathing directly into the microphone. So.
Yeah.
Sorry, Josh. In our thoughts.
Industry. Culture would have been
as he stays there 5 years, so there's, well, you know, I don't know. So he's about 21 or 22 when he gets back to on the sea. When he's when he's taking this voyage to Panama and then up to Victoria, yeah, he's still pretty young. So what I did was, they talked about how, yeah, these struggles. It was like there was fights on because they got really restless and there were fights on the ship and. I think, one guy hooked his neck with a grappling hook, you know, and yeah. So I thought, oh, there must have been a lot of hard times. And one of the other things I thought was, his name was Seraphim, as you know, which is one of the angels that stood in the presence of God. I thought, okay, there's a great Christian name, but it's a very strange name. So I took one scene, and when he's coming out to sea, you know, I think the captain yells out, "Seraphim, help me up the sail over here." And one of the mates goes, "Well, you know, Seraphim, what kind of name is that?" You know, and Joe turns to him and he remembers his mom telling him, and it's written too. It's like whenever you're feeling you're in trouble, you'll stand your ground, basically, face your opponent with anything, but just to be strong and I can't remember the main statement, but there was a little flashback of how he remembered that. Then he looked back at him and goes, "Well, Seraphim stood in the presence of God," and he goes, "No, an angel that stood in the presence of God." You know, he turns and goes, "Not an angel. You mean like with the flipping wings and all?" You know, and he takes Joe's arm and starts flipping his wings. And Joe throws him to the ground, and there's a fight, you know, a struggle there. Captain shows up and tells him, you know, what's going on here? And he goes, "Oh, we're just making fun of his name." He goes, "Oh, I see. Okay. He goes, "Well, what other name do you go by?" And he says, "Joseph." He says, "That'll be it." He goes, "You go by Joe for now on." So in the story, it's at sea. From that point on, he's no longer Seraphim. He's Joe all the way. So I was trying to figure out a way to create him from Seraphim over to Joe. I thought maybe because they made fun of his name, and by the time he arrives in Vancouver, he's Joe Fortino. So stuff like that. But no, he had the with the captain and all that struggle too. It's you know, I just the first mate who was the took over at that time. But I think that I tried to make it so Joe was I don't know, like, maybe like second or third in hand, because he worked so hard that he was more like closer to that first mate and helped out a whole lot and worked very hard to be more than just a regular sailor on the ship. But he did a lot more, and he was entrusted by those people. I mean, everybody kind of liked Joe. I would imagine there's probably some other black sailors that were probably on that ship. But then, you know, the sugarcane run was usually very commonly from Port of Spain to Liverpool and other ports, but there were probably some other black sailors that also stayed there with him while on the ship. But once he left and went to Panama and then to Victoria and then Vancouver, I'm just thinking he may have been the only one.
Yeah,
you see, because that's the environment he came into is. You know, here I am alone in Vancouver now, or Granville in Vancouver, and he's suddenly trying to make his own way as a black man in an early white society.
Yeah.
Gone are the days when my heart was young and gay. Gone are my friends from the cotton fields away. Gone from the earth to a better land I know. I hear those gentle voices calling, "Fool, my heart should feel no pain. Why do I sigh that my friends come not again? Grieving for forms now departed long ago, I hear their gentle voices calling, poor old Joe. I'm coming, I'm coming, for my head is bent and low. I hear those gentle voices calling, poor old Joe.
Discorder. That free magazine from CITR has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke weed every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are now tuned into the sounds of Discorder.
1, 2, 3, Android. Are you ready? Come on. Are you ready?
Hey, this is Wade.
And I'm Matt.